Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The first call that mattered last week from Europe to the world to save Europe's bacon and prevent a Euro meltdown went not to Washington or New York, but to Beijing. Europe needs $1.4 trillion for its new Stop the Chaos Euro deal. China's got the world's biggest pot of cash. So, will China step up? And if it does, at what price? This hour on Point, the China price for bailing out Europe. You can join the conversation. Is this it? Is this the moment when global power really shifts from west to east, when China takes charge? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We planned to go first to Beijing today, but back in Europe, Greece is not done rocking the boat. Yesterday, just when everybody thought a deal was done, Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou called for a national referendum on the big Euro deal to ask Greeks whether they are prepared to take their portion of the pain and austerity. If they say no, all bets are off. Here's Papandreou saying today he'll hold a referendum to ask the Greek citizens to vote directly on the issue.
This is the highest form of democracy. It is a great moment of patriotism for the citizens to decide. So let us then give the final word to the people and let the citizens decide. To decide not for the people and parties, but for the fate and the course of the country.
Let the people decide. The Greek people and the whole world will be watching this one. Joining us now from Athens is Alkman Granitsas, Bureau Chief for Greece and Cyprus for Dow Jones Newswires, a contributor to the Wall Street Journal. Alkman Granitsas, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What are the odds that the Greek people are going to put their hands up, go to the polls and say, yes, we want more austerity, more pain? Could this pass?
It's a very good question. The latest public opinion polls show that there is a plurality that are opposed to such a referendum, or rather, let me put it a different way. 60% of Greeks are opposed to the deal. That's the latest public opinion polls over the weekend. And if it does go to a referendum, a plurality of about 45% said they would vote down the deal.
So,
but the real issue is whether we'll even get to the referendum. The call yesterday by Papandreou has touched off political developments that are moving very quickly in Athens today. And it's not entirely clear that the current government will survive much longer.
Now, that's interesting because, I mean, you've got markets rocking all over the world in response to this note of uncertainty that everything would hang on a Greek vote. And maybe Papandreou's right. Maybe this is exactly what a democracy should be doing at this moment. But what's the alternative? You say if the government falls, another government might come in and not hold a referendum?
Well, the really scary thing is that if the government falls and we go to elections, it's not entirely clear that any party will be able to form a working majority in Greece's parliament. Both of the two major parties that have dominated the political scene for the last 30 years are scraping historical lows in their approval rating, and the polls suggest that neither party would be able to gain a 151-seat majority, which raises the prospect of going to a second round of elections. Either way, Greece looks like it's headed to a period of protracted political uncertainty.
The thing that everybody's worried about, people are calling a disorderly default. I mean, Greece is kind of in default of one kind or another already, but Europe's trying to wrap a structure around it, pour money in, stop the contagion, if you will. What do Greeks, you know, how do they look at this? If you don't put a big deal together that keeps Europe solid, Greece in the EU, you know, what's the disorderly option here?
The disorderly option would be a catastrophe. I think most Greeks recognize that, but they're also deeply conflicted over the deal. They recognize that even this so-called orderly default, this 50% haircut that European leaders agreed banks should take on their holdings of Greek government debt, is not going to be necessarily a win for the country. Yes, it reduces the debt burden, but it will probably seal Greece off from any kind of new lending for years to come. And people here speak openly about 10 years of austerity ahead. And so they're very conflicted about it. They do want to stay inside the euro, but they're not sure if this is the right deal.
Can Europe hope for some kind of certainty or clarity out of Greece, or are you just describing Greece, the kind of where this all began, as in turmoil for the next weeks or even months?
That's exactly it. I mean, from where things stand right now, Tuesday, mid-afternoon Athens time, things look very unstable. There are rumors floating around that the government may not last through the end of the day. There's also rumors that the Greek president, who holds a position above party politics, might form a national unity government where creating a caretaker government to rule Greece for several months until some kind of clarity either on the political or economic scene is found.
Wow, incredible. Europe, world, hold on to your hat. Greece, the kind of the stone that begins the building of some kind of reconstruction here, rolling itself. Alkman Granitsas, their bureau chief for Dow Jones Newswires in Athens, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
So there's Greece in all of its fluid, turmoil, or name it what you will. Let's look to China and Europe's appeal to Beijing for a bailout. This came straight off of the big deal last week. Sarkozy, the French leader, first call to Beijing and the first big airline trip out of Europe. Klaus Regling, head of the European Financial Stability Facility, that's the Euro deal, went straight to Beijing the next day on Friday to ask China to buy into the Eurozone bailout fund. He told reporters there that China would not be getting preferential treatment, at least in bonds.
When they buy our bonds, they buy the same bonds that everybody else buys. There's no special deal. It's the normal conditions. We publish those conditions on our website. And there's nothing special. They find this an interesting investment.
No special deal, said the European with his hat in his hands. Here's the China view saying there's nowhere else to go. This is Professor Xie Tao, Beijing Foreign Studies University, telling the BBC on Thursday Asia's the obvious choice, maybe the only choice, for bailing out Europe.
If you do not turn to Asia today, where else do you turn to? United States, for example, is now in its own deep debt crisis, and it's still struggling with a very high unemployment rate. You look in Asia, you have China, you look at India. So I think in Asia, you do have such a large pool of financial resources that can be used for the benefit of Europe.
And so Europe turns to China. Joining me now from Washington is Peter Botelier at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, formerly with the World Bank, now a senior advisor on China to the Conference Board, teaches China Studies. Peter Botelier, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
So does Europe have any other place they can go? China's got huge foreign reserves. Does anybody else have enough cash to step up and help them raise this $1.4 trillion, I guess, they want to stop the problem?
Well, there's no question that China has the dough to solve these short-term financial problems, if the problem could be defined as a short-term financial problem. But unfortunately, it's not. There is, of course, an acute debt, sovereign debt problem and a bank recapitalization problem. But beyond that, there is a very profound structural design problem that China cannot solve. Only the European politicians can solve that.
But China has an interest here, too. Europe is its biggest export market. It is highly dependent on exports. It's built its entire economy around that. Not enough domestic demand yet to make its own economy run. Does China have to step up and bail Europe out for its own sake?
Well, there's no question that a severe crisis in Europe, which would probably also trigger a crisis elsewhere in the OECD countries and around the world, would have severe negative consequences for China. But that does not mean that it is within China's power to solve the problem.
Okay, maybe not. It's interesting, over the weekend, Xinhua, the last couple of days, the news agency there had a commentary, and they said China's going to be a true friend and partner of Europe. But then they wrote this: however, amid such an unprecedented crisis in Europe, China can neither take up the role of a savior to the Europeans nor provide a cure for the European malaise, saying it's up to the European countries themselves to tackle their financial problems. Now, that's well and good, but there's a crisis right in front of us right now. There could be a global meltdown on the back of this. What do you think of the odds that China will actually come up with tens of billions of dollars or more for Europe in this next chapter, Peter?
I don't believe the chances are very high. The discussions that Mr. Klaus Regling had in Beijing, according to the reports I heard, really didn't go very far. The Chinese counterparts were mainly interested in the safety of a possible Chinese investments in EFSF bonds and in a high return, and possibly also on exchange rate protection. I believe that Mr. Reglin left after the weekend straight to Tokyo to see if he could persuade the Japanese to come in. Now, the next chapter in this is, of course, the visit by President Hu Jintao, who is in Vienna at the moment on a long-scheduled state visit. And from there, he will go to Cannes in France for the G20 meeting on November 3 and 4. That, I think, is the time when I think China's intentions and conditions of possible aid to Europe will become more clear.
Isn't that quite a picture? European leaders and the Chinese leader all on the Riviera, Europe begging China to help it out of this corner. I mean, this is a real historic moment here, isn't it?
Yeah, we're living in historic times. This would have been unthinkable 10 or 20 years ago. And it is a reflection of the enormous shift in power from the transatlantic community to East Asia, in particular China. China is now in a position to exert enormous financial power, economic power, and may decide to do so. It's unclear what terms they would come in, if they come in at all. If I were in their shoes, I would be very cautious because it's not strictly a financial problem. Beyond the financial dimensions of the problem, there are deep structural political design problems.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Europe still on a high wire on its finances and China as maybe the only net. We're talking about what China would ask for bailing out Europe in Europe's current crisis, a crisis that could become the world. We've been talking with Peter Bottelier. He's at the Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies, formerly at the World Bank. Seen a lot, knows a lot. Also with us now from Washington, Arvind Subramanian, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. His op-ed in the New York Times last week was titled Why China Should Bail Out Europe. His new book is Eclipse, Living in the Shadow of China's Economic Dominance. Arvind Subramanian, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Great to be here.
Peter says China may not do it. You say they should. Why?
Well, here's the thing that if you see today's news report, I think Europe is edging closer and closer to the precipice. I think all these dire scenarios that were, 5%, 10% probability about even a couple of months ago are acquiring, creeping up to the range of 60, 70, 80%. So if there is a big crisis, it's true what Peter says that there will be need to be internal structural reform, but there will need to be lots of cash to cushion the process. Now, the question is, where does that cash come from? And as everyone rightly says, that cash has to come. It's not really Asia. It has to come from one country.
Yeah.
It's only China that has that amount of cash.
That was our Chinese guest being modest there, I think.
Exactly. Let's get serious here. Maybe the oil exporters could provide some. Maybe Japan could provide some. But really, the big creditor out there is China. So it has to be China that comes to the rescue. Now, why does China have to come to the rescue? As you all said, that China will have some self-interest in this, and so that's especially if we head towards a crisis. So the question then becomes, what should China do, and what price should it extract for providing this massive assistance? And I think China should provide lots of cash. But it should do so at a price. It should do this via the IMF. And in return, it should ask for a status equivalent to that of the United States and demote Europe, which is now a debtor, a supplicant, down from the status it currently enjoys. So this is about, we talk about, is this the moment of shift? Actually, Tom, it's a shift that's been happening for the last several years, and now we're seeing the most dramatic manifestation of that. It's not as if this is the point of the shift. This is just the manifestation. It's been happening for some time, as I document in my book.
Eclipse. So you say this is not the moment of shift. It's the moment maybe, though, of acknowledgement as we come up to this.
Exactly.
And you're talking about a really historic shift in power here. I mean, the United States has had a special status in the IMF ever since the post-World War II order came into existence. And you're and Europe, of course, right there at the top also, you're talking about China saying to the West, no, we're going to be right up there at the top. And Europe, step aside.
Exactly. Now you see, your question was, what should China do? China mm-hmm. has a choice. I mean, it has three alternatives. One, it just sits by and says, you know, let the crisis unfold. And as we've all agreed, that's, you know, ultimately not in China's interest. China, as you said, depends upon European markets, and it would take mm-hmm. a big hit, like it did in 2008. I mean, it took a big hit on exports. It yep. was able to react to it. So that's alternative number one. Alternative number two, it says, you know, okay, Klaus, you came, you know, with cap in hand, you know, we'll provide you some money bilaterally. You know, we'll buy some EFSF yeah. bonds, we'll buy some Italian bonds, et cetera, et cetera. Or it could say, you know, we actually do this collectively internationally by, you know, putting our money into the IMF. I think my main point is that it's in the interest of China and it's in the interest of the world that, you know, all this money that only China has should be provided multilaterally through the IMF, because we do need a multilateral solution, you know, to the European problem rather than, you know, China and Europe, you know, sorting this out bilaterally, because that would be damaging in a number of respects.
And so we step into a new age. In your new book, Eclipse, you look at China's dominance. You say it could be comparable to that of the British Empire in the late 19th century, i.e., pretty complete power. The United States in the aftermath of the Second World War, incredible power. You're projecting that within this decade, the renminbi, the Chinese currency, will surpass the dollar as the world's premier reserve currency, or soon thereafter. I mean, these are, Peter uses the word tectonic, these are tectonic power shifts.
Yeah, exactly. These are tectonic shifts. And the point I make in my book is that, you know, China's dominance is much more imminent, going to be much broader in scope and much larger in magnitude than anyone currently imagines. You've spelt out some of the things I say in the book, but these are truly, you know, tectonic, I think is the right word. It's the word that I use in my book as well. It's really, mm-hmm. You know, and all this could unfold very, very quickly, because I in fact say that, you know, in 10, 15 years time, you know, we would see not a G20 or a G7 or even a G2. We could well see a G1, with that one being China.
Oh, gee whiz. Peter, help us here. We'll talk about structural change. And if China demands structural change, what that means? Is that, you know, shifting the deck chairs at the IMF, or is it go more deeply into Western economies? What would that mean? But you say there are three things that China might put right up front if, in fact, it all comes back around to them, hat in hand. They want to be called out formally as a market economy. They want a delisting of an arms embargo that's been there since Tiananmen. And they want the West to shut up about human rights in China. Take us into those, Peter.
Well, let me start by saying I agree with everything Arfin said. It would be in China's interest, Europe's interest, and the world's interest if the Chinese were to come in a big way to do it via the IMF. If that were to happen, then all these three points you mentioned, of course, would not be part of the game, because the IMF cannot impose that kind of conditionality.
Right.
It's clear, ideally, if China could deal directly bilaterally with Europe, that at the political level, they would like to insist on being recognized as a market economy.
That's an advantage to them, because it makes it more difficult for other countries to call them out on trade practices.
That's correct. It's a technical legal mm-hmm. issue, but as long as they are classified as a non-market economy, it's much easier to put anti-dumping duties on exporters in China
right.
than it would be if they were recognized as a market economy.
It hasn't slowed them down too much, I must note. The arms embargo, do they really need Western arms? Don't they have their own?
The arms embargo is a deep political thing. It dates back to the Tiananmen disaster of 1989. Mm-hmm. And the Europeans have declined to lift that embargo. Of course, the Americans have put heavy pressures on the Europeans not to accede to that demand.
Because the Americans have the same embargo, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And there is no way, I think, that politically that could be put on the table.
Why is that important to China, though? Do they really need Western arms? Don't they have the industrial capacity to make their own? Or is there technology they would get there?
I'm not an arms expert, so I cannot comment on it from a technical mm-hmm. point of view. But it's certainly also political, because China wants to be recognized as a equal player in the world.
Oh, I see. Just almost at the level of, it's kind of an insult to have an arms embargo.
Absolutely.
And if you're the richest one in the world, why should you tolerate that?
Yeah. Exactly. And also the Tiananmen event is so long ago, more than 20 years ago. Why do you have to maintain these embargoes? The continuation of these arms embargoes reflect the deep distrust that many countries in the West have.
Shut up on human rights. What would that mean? I mean, is the West really bugging China that much on human rights now?
Oh, yes. It's not always visible, but in all bilateral discussions between European countries and between the EU in Brussels and China, which are very structured discussions, this is always number one on the agenda. Yeah, and the Chinese, of course, don't like that at all and would like the Europeans and everybody else to shut up on human rights. Now, these three points, the arms embargo, the human rights, and the recognition of China as a market economy, cannot be part of an IMF conditionality
right.
for Europe.
But bilaterally, they could be.
Well, it's almost impossible that Europe could agree to any of the three, let alone all of the three. Since the Chinese know that, they're very unlikely to table it. It's very much in their interest, therefore, to play this whole game through the IMF, where the conditionality can be shifted to technical, organizational, administrative issues.
Right. But, Arvind, either way, you're talking a new world order here, not of the kind that George H.W. Bush envisioned back in the day.
Tom, I have a slightly different reading on this because I think actually the multilateral price and the bilateral price that China might extract are not mutually exclusive. I mean, it all depends upon, you know, the relative bar. Yeah, exactly. Not all, but I mean, you know, it's not as if you do one, you can't do the other. Mm-hmm. It all depends upon, you know, how vulnerable Europe is, you know, at the end of the day.
And you're saying it's maybe 70% at the precipice.
Exactly. And if that's the case, you know, what struck me about Klaus Regling is that, I mean, he goes to China and talks as if, you know, he has the bargaining power and said, you know, as if he's selling a very good commodity and saying, oh, China, you know, this is a product. If you don't want to take it, you
we're
know.
We're not cutting any deals with you here. Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, and my reaction is, what planet is this guy on, you know? If tomorrow Europe were at the edge, I mean, they would have to, you know, concede hell of a lot, both multilaterally and perhaps even bilaterally.
Arvind Peter, stand by if you'd be good enough. We'll come to that, but I've got so many callers here. Let's begin to bring them in with us. And in a moment, Clyde Prestowich joins us. Richie in Nashville, Tennessee. Richie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My fear is that so many countries are going to China to bail them out. Is there no fear that it could almost become a monopoly of sorts, that China has all of this debt built up, that the countries are put into such a place to where they almost have to start listening to what China has to say when it comes to things like human rights? And does that not put us in a place where we have to start fearing for ourselves?
Hey, Richie, I'll put it right to Arvind. Arvind, maybe you would take the almost off of that. I mean, you're writing, that's where we are.
Exactly. That is the fear, Richie, and it's a very good question. I mean, that is the fear that if power shifts so much in that direction, I mean, do we have to kind of soften our demands on China and acquiesce much more to what China wants? I think that is the question going forward. And so my response to that would be that the more we can do this multilaterally, because let's face it, I think China, as an exerciser of monopoly power, you know, is going to do some things that we don't like. But broadly, I think China does have a stake in maintaining the current open trading system that we have, the open financial system that we have. On human rights and politics, things are a bit different and a bit murky. But I think that's why, you know, we need to bring China in much more multilaterally so that all the things that China might demand, for example, more say in the IMF, are things that are not unreasonable. And so we want to, in some ways, you know, kind of soften the monopoly power of China by bringing it into the multilateral system.
But it brings us back to that old cynical definition of the golden rule. You know, he who has the gold makes the rules. Bobby in Winooski, Vermont. Bobby, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I think that people ought to really question the old aphorism, be careful what you wish for. Shipping of jobs and turning a communist nation, or so-called anyway, into a capitalist nation, which it is, and you can use any word you want, but it's a communist word, it's a capitalist word. Now we see the results of that. Now they can crack the whip. And now the United States and the rest of the world has to pray to China. And if I were in China, I would be careful in China's position about not destroying the whole world economy, because they're part of it too. But I would say, do it our way.
Well,
it's going to be.
Bobby, I appreciate. I mean, but how do you say do it our way when they've got the dough? On the other hand, you're right. And Arvind and Peter pointed out, they are a part of the world system too. They have a big interest in not blowing everything up. But what's the texture of this going to be? What should they ask for? Bo, thanks, Bobby. Bo in Windsor, Connecticut. Bo, you're on.
Yes, hi, Tom. Yes, I'm an ethnic Chinese, and I've lived in this country for many years.
Great.
You know, I've seen different things happening. I go back to China every year. It seems to me that, you know, the Chinese people feel that the whole Western world is demonized China, or they try to choke China for some reason. You know, people don't like all that economic growth and the power they have. But I think China wants to be recognized, wants to be part of this world stage. You know, they wanted to play their part. And I think they probably, in the end, will come up with the money to save Europe or to help. But I think for many times in the past, mm-hmm. you know, when they did something, there is a just Chinese tradition, you know, you do a favor for a friend, and later on in the future, you expect the friend to pay it back some other way. But the Chinese never seem to get that. You know, they do something to help, and immediately the Western countries would do something to humiliate.
Bo, you say they're afraid that they're Chinese people are frustrated at being sort of the West choking China, but China's done very well in the last 20 years, hasn't it?
I know, but there are reports in China that are different. You know, they try to buy certain things in the world, immediately prices go up. They're talking about the U.S. is doing two chains to block China. You know, the first chain being Taiwan, Japan, Korea, the second chain being, you know, Australia and some other countries, to, you know, their militaries, their ships over there.
It's amazing, Bo. You remind us of important things here. I mean, even with all this wealth, here's the Chinese people still thinking about history and worried about chains around them by the United States. Peter, I mean, Bo, this is a very important reminder from Bo, what she alerts us to, not to mention. China has a lot of people still in poverty, and they may not like seeing their leaders ship billions of dollars to historically rich Europe, Peter.
Well, this is a very good point. I mean, this is the first time in history that we are seeing a country emerging as a global power while it is still a developing country and on average very poor. This has never happened before.
They've got a very rich edge and a very rich central bank full of foreign currency reserves, but still hundreds of millions in third world poverty.
Absolutely. China is, the per capita income in China is less than 20% of what it is in the U.S. So the average Chinese, particularly in the rural areas, are by Western standards, very poor people.
So, Arvind, is it then politically unacceptable to, not that it matters, maybe it's not a democracy, but still they pay attention, maybe it's politically unacceptable for them to bail out Europe in their own country?
I think the caller makes a very good point, and Peter makes a very good point. This is, you know, how can the leaders justify both the fact that, you know, there are lots of poor people within China, and yet you have to, you know, you ship out all this money to save a country that's much, a region that's much richer and that historically has not been so nice to you, as Bo reminded us. But I think the point is that's why I think the terms on which China will lend, that's, I think, the way to reconcile these two interests.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Europe still on a high wire, very much so today, and China as maybe the only net. What China would ask for bailing out Europe. Peter Bottelier joins us. He is at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, formerly with the World Bank, and advisor on China to the Conference Board. Joins us from Washington. Arvind Subramanian joins us there, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, author of the new book, Eclipse, Living in the Shadow of China's Economic Dominance. You can read his recent op-ed from the New York Times at our website, onpointradio.com. www.beijingforeignstudies.org. Let's hear just a little bit more from Beijing Foreign Studies University. This is Professor Xie Tao talking last week with the BBC about what China might want in return for that European bailout. There's a recognition they're asking for here, he says.
Asking European countries to recognize China's market economy status would be a very important on China's agenda in its relationship with European Union. Remember now, EU is China's largest trading partner, larger than United States and Japan. So we do need to have this recognition before we can fully expand our economic ties with the EU countries.
Recognize China as a market economy so that they will have even more access to European markets, to markets right around the world. Clyde Prestowitz joins us now from Potomac in Maryland, founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute, counselor to the Secretary of Commerce way back in the Reagan administration, author of The Betrayal of American Prosperity and 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East. Clyde Prestowitz, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, good to be with you and with your guests.
So it's kind of incredible, Clyde. I mean, I've known you since way back in the day when the U.S. was negotiating over trade with Japan and China was still absolutely dirt poor. And now here it is, 2011, and you see this moment that the world has come to where the West has really got its hat in hand to China. Clyde, if you'd be good enough, let me read just a couple of comments from our listeners. They're bringing us on air here. First one from Chris says, you know, we need a solution. Why don't you just lease a strategic Greek island for a Chinese naval base, give them a presence in the region? Here's another says, this is a critical one of China. China bypassed all the hard work of civil society and the enormous efforts in education and governance to get everything they have, be it sold or stolen. They're on the ultimate free ride. All they have contributed to the world is cheap slave labor and lots of it. And one more from Paolo says, at what point do we start planning and implementing an offensive and defensive economic strategy with teeth? Just a flavor of what people are thinking out there. What are you thinking, Clyde, about this moment?
Well, I think it's actually maybe a little bit less dramatic than has been discussed here. I think, China is certainly a rising and important power, and it may or may not. I tend to be with Peter. I think the Chinese may hesitate, actually, to invest for the structural reasons that Peter mentioned, and also for one that you mentioned, which is that there is politics in China, and any loss of so-called national wealth, particularly at a moment, remember, China's going through a power transition themselves, an embarrassment at that moment is not something China wants or needs. So I'm not sure what China's going to do, but more importantly, I think that there are other countries in the world. For one thing, the Europeans themselves have resources. They have not tapped out all of their own resources.
You think they're just poor mouthing their own resources? They're talking poor, but they could actually do this without.
As we know, they have lots of internal structural problems and internal political problems, and the whole history of this has been too little, too late for the last 18 months.
But they're still a capital exporter on net.
Europeans have resources. They have the ability to do more, and frankly, I think they should. But then, secondly, you know, the Europeans also visited Japan this past week.
Yeah.
And Japan is a country that is also has very large reserves. There are other countries that have large reserves. So I don't see China as the absolute key to the future of Europe.
Well, let's look at that one. Arvind Subramanian, we're talking big about China, but hey, they're not the only rich cat on the block. Maybe Europe can bail itself out or have Japan or, I don't know, Brazil do it.
Well, let's take both, you know, first the European side that Clyde mentioned and then the other side. You know, it's true that Europe is a very wealthy country, but the heart of the problem in Europe is basically that there's only one really strong creditor country, and that's Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, Germany itself has a public debt to GDP ratio above 80%. So part of what you're seeing in Europe now is both a slight economic inability and certainly a political reluctance on the part of Germany to keep writing the checks. So I think, yes, Europe has, you know, resources, but I think it's reaching its limits. And if there is a big crisis, then I think Europe cannot do this alone. It will need outside money.
So what about Japan? What about somebody else?
Yeah, you see, as I've said before, the I think the oil exporters certainly have some cash which they can lend. I think Japan certainly has some money too. But remember, Japan itself has been going through this lost decade and political uncertainty within Japan itself. So really, we're talking about the one country with mountain loads of cash single-handedly can do it. But I think the key point, which the caller made, and I think which Clyde also made, and all of you made, is that how do the Chinese justify this to themselves, internally, to ship out all this money at a time of transition? And the answer to that is what the caller said. China will demand international recognition. Then if it gets that, either in the form of equal status in the IMF, market economy status, that is what the Chinese rulers will then be able to sell domestically as saying, look, the world needs us, but and we have to help them. We have problems internally, but look what we're getting in return.
So nationalistic pride, in a way,
exactly,
is the answer.
We're getting
that.
The revenge of history back. We're now on equal terms with guys who didn't treat us very well 100 years ago.
Clyde, Peter says, and Arvind too, there's going to have to be structural change here in Europe and beyond. But I wonder what that means. I mean, the U.S., what we pushed for a long, long time, and you were right at the forefront of this, was free trade. Now we're seeing China. You look at the pots on the table. Theirs is the biggest, and they're much more strategic about that. Free trade is not exactly the right word. Mercantilist, maybe. So if a structural change, is it really towards something like what the U.S. has at least stood for rhetorically and more for such a long time, or are we headed toward a mercantilist world?
Well, there are a lot of ironies here. In terms of structural change, clearly, Europe has lots of structural change to go through if they want to save, in order to save the euro, Europe is going to somehow have to come up with some kind of a central financial institution. But what I find really ironic is the point you just made, which is that we've been preaching free trade, and many of the Western powers have been preaching free trade. But it's the mercantilists who are calling the tune. Germany is a chronic surplus country in Europe, and they have the money in Europe. And China, and to a lesser extent, other Asian countries that are kind of range from soft mercantilism to hard mercantilism. And so I think the answer to your question is that we in the U.S. And other countries in the world. I think a problem.
Hey, Clyde, when you say mercantilist, could you just define that for people who don't, trade in these terms every day?
Yeah, sure. That's a good point. Yeah, essentially, countries that focus on accumulating trade surpluses, that have an economic strategy that focuses on spurring investment, suppressing consumption, exporting, and accumulating large current account, large surpluses.
Kind of the opposite of what the U.S. has done in the last decade.
The opposite of what the U.S. has done, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the point you just made is that the world is kind of divided. It's kind of half, what you might call neoclassical, liberal, laissez-faire free trade a la the U.S., and it's kind of half what I would call neo-mercantilist strategic trade, export-led growth, a la Japan or China and Korea.
But you're saying that second half won. The U.S. half lost. Well, is that I'm ideology going down in flames right before our eyes here?
I don't know if won is the right word, but what I'm saying is that the second half, the neo-mercantilist half, accumulates cash. They accumulate reserves, and because they accumulate reserves, we say that they gain power.
Isn't it a fact?
They do have the problem that if the consuming nations go broke, then they have nobody to sell to.
Right. That's a little problem.
They're trying to keep the consumers alive. But in terms of calling the tune, and really in terms of kind of wealth generation, it seems that their strategy is more successful. So I guess that going forward, there's going to have to be some kind of a convergence of the laissez-faire and mercantilist strategies.
Boy, that puts us on a different path as well. I mean, from the vision, the American vision of optimizing world trade and economies. So many callers. Richard,
Tom, let me say one more thing, if I can, because please. This question of what would the Chinese want as the price for investing poses a problem. Some of the discussants have talked about China wanting to be given a market economy status.
Yes.
Well, the problem is that it's not. You know, it doesn't kind of fit the criteria of a market economy. Half the economy is dominated by state-owned enterprise.
But they don't want to fit the criteria, and they just want the advantages of the formal status.
But this poses the problem for other countries in the system that you're being asked as a condition of getting this financial contribution, you're being asked to say that it's round when it's really square.
But isn't that the very essence of a change in power? That's China redefining terms. They're saying,
well, it is, what I'm saying is, I think that therefore there may be some resistance to that.
Yeah, no doubt. Richard, West Palm Beach, Florida, you're on the air, Richard.
Hi, Tom. I just love these experts because you get them on and they talk. China is in the driver's seat. Europe is broke. And there's no other way. How they got, 15 to 20% unemployment throughout Europe? China can do whatever they want. They're a closed society. Just like when they kicked out, I think it was the English, during the time when they had the heroin and the places where they and they just, when they said they wanted to shut down that country, they shut down that country, and nobody got in and nobody got out.
Richard, I take your point. I know it can feel that way, absolutely. On the other hand, they do sell to the whole world, a lot to Europe and the U.S. They need those markets. I mean, so there is still some countervailing forces here. A couple more. John in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. John, you're on.
Thank you, Tom. I just wanted to ask your guests two questions. The first one, from a business perspective, and they can answer it however they feel, but would it benefit China to do nothing at all, let the markets unravel, and be in a position of greater strength due to the fact that now we have to come to them even more because they are the last resort? They may take a hit in the market, but it's not like those billions and trillions of dollars are going to go away. And the second question is, I would like to know how they expect any European country to get their people behind the measures in which they promise, because you can see it's easy today. They've opened up voting to allow the country to decide on austerity measures.
For Greece to decide on that. John, let me pick that up. On the other hand, of course, Europeans know if they don't get bailed out, their whole lifestyle's in trouble. Let me hold that and get one more. Dave in Omaha, and we'll come to it. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Love you guys' program. I just wanted to quickly interject some rhetoric of my own here. Ask the Tibetan monks, how they enjoyed China being in the driver's seat. I think it's time that we took a nice long look at it. I don't care what kind of recognition China wants, as long as a large portion of their country is completely dirt poor. While the ones that are in charge, reap the benefits. That's not somebody that I want in control of the future of the globe.
Yeah, I hear you. But then we got to look in the mirror a little bit on that front ourselves, different scale. But even so, Peter, pick up this issue that John called in from Tennessee. Why wouldn't the Chinese just let it all fall to pieces? And then there they are, like the last man standing with all the money.
Well, my first reaction is it may be beyond China's power to actually decisively solve the European problem, because it's an internal European problem. So China is not facing that question, letting the world fall to pieces or not. They obviously, like everybody else, hope very much that the European leaders will find structural solutions for these problems. And once those are on the table, I think coming across with a large bag of money from Beijing is not going to be the biggest problem for them.
Okay.
The biggest problem for them is to make sure that once they make the decision to invest $100 billion or more, to in the European Stability Fund, that that money is safe and preferably will earn a decent return. That's not at all assured under the current situation.
Right.
And that's more a political problem than a financial problem. That's why, on balance, I am hesitant to agree with Arvind that China should come in, because if China comes in without assurances that their money is safe, they are digging their own grave internally.
Arvind, you say it's already done. The power's already shifted. We're sort of whistling in the wind here.
Right. You know, the gentleman who said that, you know, do we want a China that kind of controls Tibet and, you know, all these human rights things, whether, you know, we want power to shift to such a country. I think I do understand the anxiety behind that concern. But as you said, Tom, you know, we the West has put itself in a position due to, you know, bad economic management, not addressing the economic problems, to put ourselves in the situation to allow this power transition.
Well, Clyde, it's an incredible pass that we come to here. Maybe it's not. Maybe things don't shift so quickly, or maybe they've already shifted, Clyde.
Well, I think the main thing, Tom, is, you know, the old adage, never change your forecast.
Yeah.
As you know, I've been predicting something like this for a long time, and I've been sticking with it, and it looks like I'm right.
Well, here comes the weather. Batten down the hatches. Clyde Prestowitz with the Economic Strategy Institute. Great, as always, to have you, Clyde.
Thanks for having me.
Arvind Subramanian, author of Eclipse, Living in the Shadow of China's Economic Dominance. Arvind, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks. Great to be here.
And Peter Bottillier at the Johns Hopkins. Thanks a lot, Peter.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.